Of the many issues in American society, abortion is among the most controversial and divisive. But however you feel about abortion, morally or legally, I imagine this fact might surprise you that one out of every five American pregnancies ends in abortion. Chicago bioethicist Katie Watson calls this the Scarlet A.
We talk so much more about the idea of abortion than the experience of abortion. And while opinion polls are relevant, they don't tell us the whole story. And so I just wanted to write a book that took a deeper dive about human emotion and human experience in this complicated topic.
Watson joins us to talk about her new book. Plus, Politico's Natasha Kurecki has the latest on the race for Illinois governor. And we continue our series of conversations with candidates hoping to be our next Illinois attorney general. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For most of the 20th century and into the 21st, Americans have been debating the issue of abortion. Wherever you stand on that side of the debate, you may not know that one out of every five American pregnancies end in an abortion. And when we look at the number of abortions, tens of millions of them have happened legally since Roe versus Wade in 1973. Given those statistics, the sheer numbers of this, it seems logical that there should be even private conversations happening around abortion. But perhaps because the public sphere has been so poisoned, these private conversations aren't happening. So writes Northwestern University bioethicist, lawyer, and author Katie Watson in her new book, Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Katie's going to be discussing this book on Wednesday evening in Chicago. If you're there, she's going to be at the Seminary Co-op bookstore at 6 o'clock. She's with us now in our Evanston studio at Northwestern University. Katie, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
Katie, I must have been astounded to learn that there are just the numbers of this. There's 1 million abortions in the U.S. every year. I imagine as someone who studies this, were you more aware of this, these numbers?
Well, I became aware of these numbers. I was assigned when I first began teaching in medical school to teach an ethics class, a single session on reproductive ethics to medical students. And that was the first time I had looked up the numbers. And this was years and years ago. And I'm someone who had studied the constitutional law of abortion since I was in law school and was very, very familiar with the law of abortion. And it was so interesting to me that I had never had to think that hard about the sort of national experience, the epidemiology of abortion. And so I looked up the numbers, and the very first time I taught them, I explained to the class that one in three American women would have an abortion at the rate we were going at the time. And stopped to think, you know, reflect on that number and think about all the women you know in your lives and think about that one-third number between 15 and 44 before someone hits menopause. And then I went on to make my next point, and the class just kind of exploded in whispers, like turning to each other, just kind of confused, like, no, 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 no. And it's one of those moments where you just have to stop as a teacher and say, like, because I could overhear people saying, like, one in three? Is that right? Can that be right? That's not right. And I said, that does sound really high, doesn't it? And the students, we all just kind of looked at each other like, and I can't say what they were thinking, but my feeling was this idea of the fact that it didn't sound right. It's sort of a basic data point. When data doesn't sound right, you have to sit and think why. And I totally inaccurately and had to apologize to them later said, you know, maybe that includes medically when a miscarriage happens and a fetal heartbeat is gone, but they have to evacuate the uterus because it doesn't pass naturally. Just medically speaking, that's called an abortion. Maybe those numbers include those miscarriages that are, we empty the uterus to avoid infection. I went back and looked. No, they don't. That's actual termination of ongoing pregnancy. And so that was my introduction to this disjuncture between discussion of the idea of abortion and the experience of abortion. Nyla, you mentioned that one in five American pregnancies end in abortion. And I think I was shocked by that number when I learned it. But the thing that shocked me even more is lots of those pregnancies were intentional. People wanted to be pregnant. They planned to be pregnant. If you only look at unintended pregnancies, about 42% of unintended pregnancies end in abortion. And those, not every unintended pregnancy is unwanted. Many people are the, you know, third whoops baby of the family that was unexpected, unintended, but absolutely welcome. That's just unintended. That's not unwanted. So 42% of unintended pregnancies ending in abortion. So abortion is not an uncommon choice or an uncommon experience in America, though you wouldn't know it from the way we speak to one another privately or in our public conversation. The fact that millions of women, very often in partnership with their male partners, making decisions and acting on them together, you wouldn't know that from our conversations politically. It seems like a marginal activity.
And so that's what I wanted to talk to you about, not just the public and the private conversations and the data that you have, that sort of this whole concept of what you call a quote unquote ordinary abortion. And I want to get into the language and the terminology of all this, because this is so charged. We even, I think, have to sort of dissect the language of all of this. But first, I just wanted to ask you, it struck me as I was reading this that it's not, this isn't a conversation I've had with very many people in my life about if these are the numbers of how many women are having abortions and how many times their partners also, as your research shows, it's a decision that's made oftentimes with a partner within a relationship. I feel like no one's talking about this.
Mm-hmm. That was my experience too. I had had some very limited experiences of people sharing their abortion stories with me. And there are multiple reasons for this. One is the stigma. So why bring it up if you think it might be unpleasant? And one woman I interviewed for the book, and so the book is full of women's stories talking about their abortion experiences and this, what I call ordinary abortion, which are the more common reasons for abortion. She says, you can't bring it up at a dinner party. At what dinner party can you bring this up? And I ask her why, because she's completely pro-choice. She feels very confident in her decision was the right one for her.
Or women who say they're feminists, or men who say they're feminists.
Yeah.
They're not talking about this.
They're not ashamed of it. But she said she felt like she would be either trying to provoke someone into a fight or ask them to feel sorry for her. And I thought that was so profound. It was sort of like, well, what am I looking for? Why would I do that? The idea that there's so many more downsides than upsides, that when the conversation is about abortion or politics or something that would be relevant, and she's with people she loves and trusts, it crosses her mind that she could or perhaps should say, well, you know, I had an abortion and blankety blank, whatever the next thought would be that would be relevant. And every time she passes. I spoke to another young woman who is not in the book, and I thought this was so fascinating. She was feeling guilty that she wasn't joining the sort of shout your abortion type, you know, be very public about it. And she said the reaction she feared more than judgment was pity, that even pro-choice friends might say, oh, I'm sorry. And she said that just made her crazy. She didn't want to hear anyone say she was sorry. She said they should give me a high five and say, like, way to go, way to do what was right for you. So she was afraid of, quote unquote, positive reactions, but that wouldn't jibe. And all this goes to women very reasonably wanting to define their own experience, wanting to define their own reality, wanting their emotional reaction to be the emotional reaction, and feeling like if they open this topic, some of that might be taken away from them. That's sort of what I took away, that the desire to be the authors of our own stories, to control that narrative. And this narrative is so contested that for anyone to say anything that doesn't fit a cookie cutter version that we already know, or you're not already guaranteed that the person you're speaking with agrees with you exactly, it just doesn't feel worth it, which is a problem. I'm not blaming those women. They're responding to reality and doing what's best for them. But it makes our national conversation and our personal understandings really desperately thin.
And that said, Katie, who did you write this book for? Is this book for? Because I imagine there are people who are listening now who might be thinking, I don't want to hear about this. I don't think abortions are right.
Sure. Oh, so people who don't think abortions are right, I think, would want to hear about it. Because I think anyone in a contested area, one of the first steps to engaging in that contested area is to understand, why do other people not see the world the way you do? And I have this issue, certainly, I've observed this with people who are staunchly pro-choice politically, saying, I just can't understand how anyone else could see it differently. So regardless of where one falls on this issue, I think trying to understand other people's points of view can only be a positive step towards a more productive conversations. I also think we're confused in this country about the relationship between law and ethics. And as a lawyer who is a medical ethicist, that's something I think about a lot. Abortion is a constitutional right. It's been a constitutional right for 45 years. And my legal analysis is that I think the Supreme Court got it right in Roe versus Wade. That is completely separate than the ethical conversation. So to say one is pro-choice is to say, I either agree with the constitutional analysis of the Supreme Court, or even if that went away, I think as a policy matter, abortion should be legal. To say something is legal or a constitutional right really doesn't say much about whether it's a good thing to do, the right thing to do, if in any particular circumstance or in generally. So Nyla, I could say to you, I hate what you just said. I want you to stop saying things like that. Don't say that again. No one interprets me as saying, I think you shouldn't have a First Amendment right of free speech. I think the government should come shut you up. It's just this, I'm telling you who I am and where I stand. And if we can't get on the same page, we're probably not going to be able to be friends. And I'd like to persuade you otherwise. I could come evangelize to you about my religion and say, I really think you should join my religion. It's the best. And you're really going to be sorry if you don't. That doesn't mean that I'm saying I want to live in a theocracy. We're clear about that in other areas. And there's a way in which abortion is another sort of morality law issue, where the Supreme Court made no comment on the moral status of embryos or fetuses, saying they didn't have any or they had a lot. It said there's no way to prove that in a secular way. And so that's going to be a matter of conscience. So I have certainly met people who say they're pro-life, and we talk about it a lot. And then I say to them, what do you think about the legality of abortion? And I have just been shocked. I would have assumed earlier that meant they were against abortion's legality. How many of them say, oh, well, it can't be illegal. I mean, I don't want women to get hurt, or that doesn't make sense, or whatever. I just don't want anyone to ever have one. I think it's a horrible thing to do. Similarly, I've talked to people who are just staunchly pro-choice, who then will whisper to me, but I'm just not sure, you know, like ethically, like, I mean, that could become a baby. I've had kids. I don't like it. I also wanted to use it as a launching pad for conversation, or help it be a launching pad. So I wrote it for book clubs. I wrote it for undergraduates. I wrote it for people who like to read interesting nonfiction before bed. It wasn't meant to be a political screeching tract, and it's not meant to be a philosophy textbook. What I tried to do is, I'm a scholar in bioethics and medical humanities, and I'm a lawyer. And what I wanted to do is translate that work, translate those disciplines, and look at the question and issue of abortion through those lenses, to take the best social science research that's out there, to take the best narrative theory that helps us think about what stories we tell and how we tell them and what that says about us as a culture, to take my decades of legal work to help people understand, like, so many people say, oh, Roe v. Wade, yes. And then you say, what exactly did it say? And like, just blank, awkward stares. And I teach incredibly, incredibly brilliant medical students. And it's just shocking to me when I say, okay, so just tell me, just spitballing one sentence, one phrase, what's your understanding of the law of abortion in the United States? And it's just crickets. And someone will raise their hand and say, it depends what state you live in. And then someone else will say, it's mostly legal, but not, you know, and it's just like,
so is that even, it's kind of, that also blew my mind. Like, is that even discussed in medical schools? Do medical schools not talk about this with doctors?
Well, I can't speak, you know, I haven't done a survey of every medical school in the United States. I certainly speak with them about it, but not every medical school has a lawyer on the faculty. So just as I was trained as a lawyer with a focus in constitutional law and a fellowship in reproductive freedom in my third year, a civil liberties fellowship, I never learned about the medicine of abortion per se. I don't think that the medical students learn about the law of abortion. They learn something, it depends on the medical school you go to, about the medicine of abortion. And then if they go on and do a residency in OBGYN, they'll learn more. But they don't learn so much about the law. And my point when I teach bioethics, and then I also teach legal elements too, is that you, no matter what field you go into, what specialty I should say in medicine, you're sort of the cocktail party representative of your field at every American cookout and cocktail party. And so you should have a basic understanding of these medical issues that have become political and legal issues as well, whether it's assisted dying or abortion care or fill in the blank. So it's not that they all have to be experts, but if I take them as a very well-educated cross-section of just American 25-year-olds, I'm worried.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Katie Watson. She's a bioethicist. She's a lawyer. She's an author. Her new book is called Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Stay tuned.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, presenting a public history exhibit in the north-south corridor of the University of Illinois Main Library throughout the month of February, with highlights from a century in publishing and design. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Northwestern University's Katie Watson. Katie, you're still at Northwestern, right? You're also at the ACLU, but you're still at Northwestern?
Yes. I've been at Northwestern for over 10 years. And a year ago, I decided to split my time and dust off my bar card. So I became a senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Illinois' Women and Reproductive Rights Project in half my week, and I still do my teaching and scholarship at Northwestern's medical school in half my week.
And her new book is called Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Katie, I think this term ordinary abortion, so we've talked a little bit about the numbers, the fact that if you look at the way that the numbers are trending, 1 in 3 American women will have an abortion. What do you mean by, you use a couple terms in your book that I thought we should talk about, safe abortions, ordinary abortions. What do you mean when you use those terms?
Mm-hmm. So the newest data, let me just say, is that with women 15 to 44 years old currently, 1 in 4 of them will have an abortion. The rates have gone down, and they're the lowest they've been since 1973.
Thanks for correcting me on that.
Thanks. So, but what's so interesting is they're the lowest they've been in 45 years, and it's still 1 in 4 women between 15 and 44 will have one. So I still think that's a very high number. I use the term ordinary abortion to try to capture something that I think is missing from the American abortion conversation. I have noticed that the cases we discuss the most are the ones that happen the least. And that's true on both quote unquote sides, that those who oppose abortion highlight cases that happen right before viability in the 20 to 24 week range, which is in very small number of cases. Or other cases that they would call, quote, abortion abuse. And then those who favor abortion rights will talk about, you know, 12-year-olds or rape victims or people with severe fetal anomalies. And those are real cases, too. But those numbers are small. When I use the term ordinary abortion, I mean the vast majority of abortions that are not those cases and that we're not talking about.
And so what does that look like? Yeah.
So I use ordinary to refer to how common it is, but also the reasons that women give. The best research available right now on why women have abortions surveyed a large number of women in abortion clinics about to have an abortion, asked them why. Women were allowed to choose more than one reason, and the average number was 4, which I just find fascinating in and of itself, that this is a multifactorial decision for so many people. But the numbers are the over 70% who say having a baby right now will significantly disrupt my work, my education, or my personal life. The 75% or so who say I can't afford to have a baby right now. The large number that say I either don't want to be a single parent or I'm having relationship problems. I think of this as the I don't want to have a baby right now is the, you know, meta reason for all this. And not that I had a dramatic medical problem that I discovered in week 21 or I'm 12 or I was assaulted. Again, very important, very real. But the majority of cases we're not talking about. So I call it ordinary in the sense that these are the most common reasons as well. And then lastly, it's ordinary medically, just to point out that abortion is a phenomenally safe medical procedure. When you think about medical procedures, that your odds of dying from an abortion are comparable to running a marathon or going to the dentist. It's something that in the first trimester, when most abortions happen, so 80% of all abortions happen when a woman is carrying an embryo. Not a fetus. They happen before that 10-week mark after a woman's last period, so 8 weeks after conception. So even when we talk about fetal rights and the fetus, that's 20% of abortions. Does that matter? Maybe, maybe not. To some people it does, to some people it doesn't. But that in that stage, it can be done in a 5-minute procedure of vacuum aspiration with an ibuprofen often. So it's ordinary in the medical sense that it's routine, safe. We know a lot about it medically. So I use that term just to kind of refocus the conversation. To say that it's ordinary or common doesn't mean it's good or right, right? That's a separate conversation. But the thing I noticed is this. In medical ethics, one of the premises of the entire bioethics and medical ethics revolution is that patients are moral agents. And clinicians are moral agents. The idea that it's not just the doctor knows best, that patients take medical facts and filter them through their own personal or religious values and their own life circumstances, and through that filter, take the medical facts and decide what's right for them and their bodies and their lives. And we grant that moral agency to all patients. However, in this conversation, I felt like the women and couples who were choosing to end pregnancies were not being granted that moral agency. This idea that they were just thoughtless libertines who didn't understand, because I guess they're just stupid, or they did understand embryonic and fetal development and they're just murderous monsters. And that's just never how we would speak about any other patient or any other clinician. And so while I am very respectful of people who oppose abortion on moral grounds, the moral case for abortion really hasn't been articulated very broadly because we have this idea we abortion's immorality, as one school of thought, is often juxtaposed against the concept of choice. In medical ethics, we call that autonomy, and it's a rich concept that is very value-laden, the idea that the person who makes the decision should be the person who's most affected by the decision. So there's values under that approach. But because then women and couples get to make this decision for themselves when they do choose to have an abortion, because it is so stigmatized, we so rarely hear their moral reasoning.
Well, we also don't hear, to your point, from people who are affected by this, whether it's the woman or the partner or other people.
Mm-hmm. We don't hear them say, A, they did this, and B, we don't get to hear them to, in a completely friendly, open way, say, oh, why? How did you think about that? What led you to decide that? Why did you think that was a good thing or an okay thing to do? We don't get to hear that moral reasoning. So in this book, I review different schools of moral theory and moral reasoning in a way that's meant to be accessible to help you understand. Maybe they think of it like this. Maybe they think of it like that. And maybe, you know, regular people are not philosophy professors articulating these, you know, long paragraphs of moral theory, but that they're moral thinkers, they're moral agents. And so nobody who has a termination thinks that it is the equivalent of putting a gun to an adult's head and shooting them, or they wouldn't do it.
There's a story that I found astounding in your book, and I think it kind of encapsulates everything we've been talking about. And it's about an abortion doctor who treats one of the women who regularly picket outside of one of her clinics. Can you share that story?
Yes. Yeah, so a physician shared this story with me, and I'll say the stories I use are anecdotes that are used to illustrate data, which is the amazing social science and epidemiologic research of others that I try to bring to the reader, sort of the best that's in the literature in the field. But I never used a story in the book that I hadn't heard from more than one person. So in other words, I'd heard a different story from someone else. The idea of treating a protester, this is not the only story out there. But so this physician had the policy. So people who come to an abortion clinic will typically see other staff members before they see the physician. So nurses or other assistant staff, and then a counselor, and then ultimately seeing the physician. In this clinic, the physician always asks the staff if someone seems unusually upset or tearful or angry, she wants to see them before they see the counselor. She wants to speak with them about what's going on. And so a patient was flagged that this patient had been unusually tearful and angry at the sonographer. And when she came in to talk to this patient, she was surprised to recognize her. And this patient was a regular picketer at a different clinic. And this physician worked at two clinics, and the patient had been picketing the other clinic very regularly, and had come to the different clinic a couple hours away elsewhere in Illinois. And she said to the person, you know, to talk to her about what's going on, what makes you think abortion is the right decision for you today, are you sure you want to have an abortion, all those kind of conversations that physicians have with any patient who's appears conflicted. And this patient said, abortion is murder, it's never the right thing to do, but it's what I have to do and it's what I'm here to do. And so the doctor pressed further, and I'm summarizing the conversation that I report in the book, and it says, you know, I recognize you from our other facility, and I'm worried that you're at risk for regret. You obviously have strong feelings about this issue. Are you sure? You know, we could talk about this another day. What are all your options going home pregnant? And the protester insisted on having an abortion for all the same reasons other people give, this quote unquote ordinary abortion, that she, where she was in her job right now, she couldn't have a baby, that she didn't want to be tied to the man that she got pregnant with, all these other ordinary reasons. And in her record, she had had one abortion earlier, but the physician thought, well, she must have changed her mind on the topic because obviously she's out there picketing. So she became convinced, the physician, that this woman really sincerely wanted to have an abortion, that she had thought it through, that this was, she thought, her best choice. And the counselor spoke with her at length and confirmed that, you know, she seemed certain of her decision. She really wanted to have an abortion. And the physician thought it would be discriminatory to hold her to a higher standard than other patients. So she did what the patient asked and ended the pregnancy. Then later she went to do a shift at that other clinic and saw her back on the picket line. And it was so fascinating. You know, the physicians who provide this care are often so much kinder than perhaps I might be. Just thinking about it in the abstract, I said, were you tempted to out her, you know? And she just looked at me like I was crazy. This physician just said, no, why would, no? You know, just the confidentiality is so deeply rooted in them. And I said, well, what did you think? Just thinking, oh, she had to think something mean or snarky or frustrated or whatever. And she just smiled and said, I thought good for safe legal abortion. She looks like she's recovered perfectly. And she just said, the physician said, she probably feels tormented. I don't need to add to that. And just walked on and went to her job. And to me, that just highlights that when we talk so much more about the idea of abortion than the experience of abortion. And while opinion polls are relevant, they don't tell us the whole story. And I'm not suggesting that everyone who opposes abortion would have one if they had an unintended pregnancy. Similarly, I think it's obvious that every pro-choice person wouldn't necessarily terminate an unintended pregnancy, right? That people do whatever is right for them, but that we're very conflicted in the United States on multiple levels. And so I just wanted to write a book that took a deeper dive and a more sympathetic and honest view about human emotion and human experience in this complicated topic.
Katie, we just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to just end by asking you about your own personal experiences. You write about your own reproductive experiences in this book, including the fact that you started writing this when you were pregnant. And I wonder how that informed your work.
Well, yeah, it did deepen my work. I started writing it long before I was pregnant. I wish a book only took the length of a pregnancy. You can make a child much faster than you can make a book, it turns out. But I did become pregnant toward the end of the writing process. And I, having the experience of going through a completely normal pregnancy and experiencing that nausea and that fatigue and the kickboxing of a third trimester fetus and delivering a child and the intensity of nurturing a newborn really deepened my understanding at a visceral level, both of the embryonic and fetal development process. I will never believe that the one-celled fertilized egg organism that became my son is a person. And I will never forget that if nurtured and a pregnancy continues, it will become a person. And I think that that's just, it's hard. It's challenging. Embryos and fetuses are liminal creatures. They're in betwixt and between. They are becoming. And that's hard to think about. But I also, it was such a visceral reminder of what hard work and what intimate labor pregnancy is. And to think of, imagine living in a world in which the government could force childbearing is incomprehensible to me as a woman, as a lawyer, as an American. Forced childbearing cannot be part of the American constitutional fabric. It isn't, and it can never become so. And I think becoming pregnant, as I was thinking about these issues and going through a very desperately much wanted pregnancy and thinking how hard it was to feel occupied by this very selfish roommate who was awake and kicking when I wanted to sleep, and all those things, to feel my body occupied in that way and think what that experience would be like if I actually didn't want the end result of having a child and it was the government forcing me to do that, it really made me feel more passionate about defending the rights of women who are pregnant and don't want to be. And it also made me more passionate about defending the rights of children, and making sure in the United States we take care of those children that we have. I have to share, Nyla, that I am just sick about the energy, time, money, and political capital that we've spent in the United States over the last 45 years on the abortion wars. And I look forward to a future. Imagine if we took all of that money, time, energy, and political focus and spent it on family and child welfare issues. I just can't imagine what fabulous strides our country would make forward. And for those who oppose abortion, it would also help women in that group who say, who have terminations and say the reason is because I can't afford to have a baby. It would interrupt my work in a way that I can't do. Why don't we create a world in which that group of women don't need to end their pregnancies, and then those who want to end their pregnancies can, and we take the best care possible of all the children and families that we do have and ensure that they flourish.
Katie Watson teaches at Northwestern University as a bioethicist. She's also an attorney with the ACLU, and her new book is called Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Katie, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, we started airing our interviews with the candidates for Illinois Attorney General. Our current Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, isn't running for re-election. There are 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans hoping to take her place. The primary is on March 20th. Here's how we did all of these interviews. In the interest of fairness, we asked all of the candidates more or less the same questions, like a job interview. We also recorded these in advance to give no one an unfair advantage. They're airing in random order over the next few weeks. Today, we're hearing from Nancy Rotering. She's the mayor of Highland Park. She's held office in that North Shore Chicago suburb since 2011. She's also the founder of the Highland Park Highwood Legal Aid Clinic. She's one of 8 Democrats running for attorney general. I spoke with her from our studios in Evanston at Northwestern University. Mayor Rotering, welcome to the 21st.
I'm really happy to be here, Nyla.
So as mayor of Highland Park, you were involved in a case, the city's ban of assault weapons that helped by the Brady Center to Prevent Violence went all the way to the Supreme Court. That was in 2015. What inspired you to run for attorney general now?
My parents raised me to be an advocate and to take action whenever we see an opportunity to really help heal the world. And as cliche as that may sound, it's just what's driven me into public service throughout my career. I really value the job that Lisa Madigan has done. I think she's been a terrific advocate, but I also see an opportunity for somebody with my background. I have an MBA from Northwestern and a law degree. I've worked in business and in law, and also, having now been mayor for 7 years, have had the opportunity to lead a government branch, to manage a large budget, a number of, hundreds of employees. And I see this as an opportunity to bring all of those skills, all of those experiences together and couple them with my passion for advocacy and serving the people of Illinois.
You mentioned Lisa Madigan. She's joined several other attorneys general in occasional lawsuits against the Trump administration. Do you see that as part of the role of the attorney general to take on the federal government?
Very much. And it's never been as important as now to have someone who's principled and independent and passionate about standing up for civil rights and human rights, the very fundamental rights of our democracy. I had the opportunity about a month ago to go to Washington and meet with those Democratic attorneys general and meet really the true superheroes of today, the people who are standing up and taking action against the travel ban, taking action against the rollback of environmental protections, standing up for health care and contraceptives as part of health care. They are really doing the heavy lifting right now. That's one piece of this job that really appeals to me.
What do you see the role as attorney general as doing?
I really see it as having probably 3 prongs. First, of course, being the chief legal counsel for the state, both on the criminal and on the civil side. Next, really being an advocate for the people in terms of new legislation that's coming through the Illinois General Assembly, proposing new laws, moving things forward that benefit the health, safety, and life of the people of Illinois. And then that other piece, being that advocate, standing up for the people and really protecting their constitutional rights.
That said, if you were elected, what would be your priorities?
I would focus on what has been a strong foundation coming out of the Attorney General's office: consumer protection, environmental protection, immigrants' rights, rights for victims of crime, helping labor and working families, but then also folding in a few really important key areas such as gun violence prevention, addressing corruption head on, and making our criminal justice system and reforming thereof a priority, because we've seen real impacts, especially in Chicago, where people are being disparately impacted by the criminal justice system. I think all of those areas really are ripe for more action coming out of the Attorney General's office.
You mentioned gun violence. I mentioned earlier the lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court. That was an assault weapon ban,
right,
that you helped institute in Highland Park.
Correct.
What's your position on the Second Amendment?
So it is the law, and it is the job of the Attorney General to uphold the law of the land. That being said, there are, I feel, areas where common sense needs to come into the conversation. A very clear example of that would be the licensing of gun dealers. And so that was something, a step that the Illinois General Assembly could have taken that would have drastically reduced the number of guns that were available to criminals on the streets and in the neighborhoods of Chicago in particular. They failed to take up that bill. They failed to take that vote in the last session. A number of people were concerned that they would be primaried if they took action. To me, that's really an abrogation of responsibility. It was up to them to take that action to help save lives and instead they chose to save their jobs. There are other areas where we can talk about safe storage requirements. We can talk about banning bump stocks, the accessory that was used in Las Vegas to create essentially a machine gun out of a semi-automatic rifle. Machine guns have been illegal in this country since the 1930s. There should be no reason why anybody should be able to access that type of an accessory and create something like that out of a weapon that they own. So I feel that currently, the Illinois General Assembly has thrown up its hands, has given up. To me, it's a real opportunity for someone who has been a strong advocate, who has taken action, had courage to stand up to the NRA, which is what happened in Highland Park when we passed our ban, and move this conversation forward in a way that really balances the rights of people.
Mayor Roetering, you're one of a very crowded field of seven others who are running for the Democratic nomination, two others for the Republican. Why should voters choose you?
I bring decades of experience in advocacy. I bring a record of getting things done. In my city, you mentioned we created a legal aid clinic. I did that out of a need that I saw from the people who really were the most vulnerable in my community. We now provide free legal services in the areas of immigration, domestic violence, and housing. The very real emergent situations, loss of home, loss of family, loss of life. That kind of experience, that kind of record of achievement will be very impactful for the next attorney general. And I do bring in that experience in the executive branch of government that lends itself to strong leadership in the attorney general's office.
Nancy Roetering is the mayor of Highland Park. She's been mayor since 2011 from where she lives in North Shore, Chicago suburb, based Highland Park. She's also the founder of the Highland Park Highwood Legal Aid Clinic, speaking to us here in Evanston at Northwestern University. Mayor Roetering, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Wonderful to be with you, Nyla. Thank you.
So we're less than 2 months from the primaries on March 20th to shift from attorney general to the race for governor. There's certainly been no shortage of campaign news from this past week and this weekend. Here to help us understand all of it is Politico's Natasha Kurecki. She's also the author of the Illinois Playbook newsletter. Hey, Natasha, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Natasha, let's start with the ad that Republican State Representative Jeannie Ives is running. She this is one of a couple ads, but this one has gotten a lot of attention, especially over the weekend, with everyone from Republican Attorney General candidate Erica Harold to the Illinois Republican Party condemning the ad. Can you explain what was in this?
Sure. I mean, what the Jeannie Ives campaign was trying to do is, what the ad did do was kind of use caricatures of different social issues to hit Bruce Brown, or saying that he was too far to the left. So they had someone, for instance, who appeared to be a transgender individual saying, "Thank you for allowing me to use the girls' bathroom," but it appeared to be a man dressed as a woman. They had somebody dressed up as an Antifa individual who, opposes immigrants, is far to the left, and said thank you for allowing illegal immigrants into our country. It was a play on Rauner's own ad that he had been running, saying thank you, Mike Madigan. This one says thank you, Bruce Rauner, and essentially was all these different social issues that they were pointing to.
Right. And so what else? So have we heard from Governor Rauner? Have we heard from other members of the Republican Party about this ad?
So who we've heard from are a lot of people who are around Rauner, allies of his who are running, including Darlene Sanger, who's running for controller, Erica Harold, who's running for Illinois Attorney General. These are people who, and Tim Schneider, the head of the Republican Party. These are all people who Rauner supports and in fact, funds at least a portion of their campaigns. But Rauner himself has not said much about it. I did get a comment from the campaign yesterday saying the ad has no place in Illinois. But Rauner himself has not come out and said, this needs to be, taken down. He hasn't said the things that his allies have said. And it's like he doesn't want to get into the muck of it. There might also be a danger of, hey, we're still in primary mode, and there's a danger that he could be alienating even further some of these people who Ives is trying to point to in the first place, conservative Republicans who are livid with Rauner for signing an abortion, a bill that expands public funding of abortion in some instances in Illinois.
And I was going to ask you about that, Natasha, because certainly on the national level, we've seen the Republican Party isn't exactly unified. I wonder if you would, to what extent you see this ad and the responses to that are a reflection of that here in Illinois.
I'm sorry, unifying?
Of a stratification, actually, of the Republican Party. Yeah, the opposite of unification.
It absolutely shows, it's an illustration of the Republican Party at war with itself here in Illinois, you know, much like elsewhere in the country. You have different segments splitting apart and fighting with each other. And in fact, you know, people like Dan Prost, who was a supporter of Rauner's, has now defected and gone to Ives. Dick Uline, the conservative donor, who had been supportive of Rauner, now is supporting Ives. In fact, with a $2 million donation last night. So I do think that this was kind of the fight over, you know, at least the social segment of the Republican Party. And what Ives keeps saying, in essence, is let's make Rauner pay for the fact that he betrayed us, the fact that he, you know, lied to us, told us that he didn't have a social agenda, in fact, put in all these policies that she calls leftist. But I would add that now Rauner can point to this and say, see, this is what you would get if you didn't have me. It would be someone who's very extreme, someone who mocks all these social issues. These are very serious issues that people take personally in Illinois, and these people are getting mocked on this ad. So it created a really interesting wedge in the Republican Party and elsewhere.
Right. And we saw that play out this weekend. I wanted to ask you about the Democratic side of this race. Of course, I think we probably heard from every Democratic candidate saying that they do not approve of this ad or this advertising. But I wanted to ask you actually about polling. We haven't seen a great deal of polling, but last week We Ask America released one about the Democratic side of the race. What were the big takeaways for you from this poll?
Big takeaway was that Daniel Ziff had moved into second place, which is what a lot of people had thought. So J.B. Pritzker would not surprise most people, given the amount of airtime he's had and the amount of money he's spent, that he is, you know, and all the endorsements he's gotten, that he was far in the lead. But Chris Kennedy, who has the name recognition and the legacy behind him and his family, had moved into third place. And he's been having a lot of different difficulties within his campaign structure. But Daniel Biss is sort of, you know, breaking through. He socked his money away. He's running ads now. So it came at a good time for Biss. After the We Ask America poll came out, Pritzker released his own numbers, showing that he had a much greater lead than the We Ask America poll. It showed him up by almost 20 points, but it still showed Daniel Biss in second place with 17 percentage points. It still had Pritzker in a big lead, but Biss is still pushing ahead, and he's really been, particularly in the last 3 days, hitting Pritzker really hard and kind of, you know, poking through and saying, hey, here I am. I am the person he has to beat now, not Kennedy.
You know, Natasha, we just have about a minute or so left. I wanted to ask you one last question. So the big asterisk of all of these polls is that almost 40%, 38% of respondents are undecided. And I wanted to ask you also just about the fact that they divided the geography in the poll between Cook County and, quote, downstate. And it said that Senator Biss had more support in suburban Cook County, but Pritzker was doing better in, quote, downstate. Just wanted to ask you your thoughts on that.
So I do think that Pritzker has done more work downstate. He has opened offices down there. Biss has gotten more of the, you know, quote unquote, like liberal college campus. He just went on a college campus tour. I mean, he's very well liked there. He's a former a college professor. So that is kind of the difference there. But it's also just kind of Pritzker has long said, look, I'm not just going to run in Cook County. I'm going to run statewide, and I'm not going to ignore downstate. And that was something that was really important to Democrats who and different unions that supported him, saying this cannot just be I win one county by a great, you know, an amazing number. you have to pick up stuff from other parts of the state and care about other parts of the state.
Yeah, so we'll see, Natasha, how that plays out for the rest of for the next 2 months. I want to thank Natasha Kurecki. You can read her Illinois Playbook, that newsletter, every morning. Thanks for being with me, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. Thanks for listening.